Okay, good morning. Bio 241. We're sort of in the middle of neurophysiology chapter, and it is February 26th. We were just beginning to talk about action potentials last time a little bit, and I passed out a figure that's not in your book, but you should become familiar with how to label that figure that I passed out. Okay, so as it's coming around, take a copy and just keep passing it. The key is also on the backside of that. Okay, so what we see on this slide right here is a picture of an action potential. So you should have a good feel for what that term really means. A potential is what? Potential is, you could think of it as potential energy, right? But potential just means voltage. And voltage actually kind of just means potential energy. There's a separation of charge, and there is energy in that gradient of that electrical charge. Action, on the other hand, means what? Something is happening, moving around, right? The voltage is changing. So it's not just resting membrane potential. Something's actually changing. And what you see with an action potential, it's a plot of membrane potential versus time, right here. And you should be able to reproduce this figure just from memory too. All right, so just make sure that you can draw this thing out and understand what's going on. And so this is where we were last time. We talked about where this takes place. Right, action potentials take place on an axon. That's the part of a neuron starting at the axon hillock. So action potentials do not occur on dendrites and cell body. There are different electrical events that happen there. We'll talk about that next. But we're just talking about how a nerve impulse is propagated down an axon. So if I were to ask you that question, how is a nerve impulse propagated down an axon, you would say a nerve impulse is an action potential moving along an axon. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I got some more. Right here. I'll also put these on the website or in Blackboard or some way for you to find them pretty easily. Okay, but you just might want to kind of start thinking. Who needs one of these things? Yeah? Okay. Take one and just keep passing them around back that way. Yeah. Almost. An action potential is what we're looking at here. It's just a change in voltage across the membrane due to certain kinds of proteins that are in the membrane at that location. And what a nerve impulse is an action potential in one location and then how it moves down the axon. All right, so an action potential is what you see on the board. Okay, you see change in voltage over time at one location at an axon. But a nerve impulse is how that action potentially actually moves along an axon. So it's a little bit different. So a nerve impulse is made up of action potentials as it moves down an axon, okay? All right, so let's start with just an action potential first and not worry about how it's moving or where it's moving or what direction it's moving. Let's just look at the changes in voltage. All right, and some parts to the action potential. Again, so it's just what voltage versus time at one location. And where would you think this location is? Could this be on a dendrite? You would say no. If I ask you, could this be on the cell body of a neuron? You would say no, because the only places that have the proper membrane proteins are at an axon, all right, or on an axon, membranes of axons, including the axon hillock. Okay? So the stimulus right here, well, let's just start with resting membrane potential. Resting membrane potential is typically about minus 70 millivolts. And if we stimulate this axon, it's going to cause the voltage to move from minus 70 closer to zero. All right, so if it moves from minus 70, maybe a better way of saying this, maybe if it moves from RMP closer to zero, right, so here's zero up over here, what do we call that? Yeah, it is depolarization, and a depolarization is a stimulus. All right, so now those two words you can kind of use interchangeably when we start with resting membrane potential. All right, the next concept is that if the stimulus is sufficient, if it reaches threshold, right, then something else is going to happen on these cells. And the membrane proteins are called voltage-gated channels. So when the voltage reaches, I can't quite read this, it's not quite minus 60, let's say minus 55. When the voltage reads minus 55, that's going to cause a conformation change in some channel proteins. And the two that you should be familiar with would be the sodium channels and the potassium channels. All right? And in particular, they both will start opening, and it's just that the sodium channels are the faster of the two. So sodium channels open faster. All right? So now sodium has a way to move across the cell membrane because the channel is open. Will sodium actually move across the membrane once the channel opens? And why? You should have a good feel for why that is. Yeah, because of the electrochemical gradient. There are two things. There's just a concentration gradient, and then there's the electrical gradient. And are either one of those drawing sodium one way or the other across the cell? Yes. Okay, let's just start with concentration gradient first. Where is sodium the highest? Outside the cell. So it's going to want to rush inside the cell down its concentration gradient. Is that an active or passive process? Okay, I hear both. You know, that's just passive, right? When something moves from high concentration to low, that's just a passive process. So sodium will enter the cell. What about the electrical gradient? Will sodium be drawn inside the cell due to the electrical gradient? Yeah, because opposite charges attract each other and is negative on the inside. So sodium rushes inside the cell very rapidly as a result when those sodium channels open. So, and don't forget, sodium is an ion. It's a positive ion. And when it rushes in, what happens to the membrane potential or the membrane voltage? It becomes more positive, right? Because sodium is a cation. And that's what we see right here. We see a sharp change in membrane potential as sodium rushes inside the cell. All right, so this phase of an action potential we call depolarization. All right, then at this point right here, remember that voltage-gated channels can change conformation, but they also have another kind of structure associated with them, and that's called an inactivation gate. And it has its own time constant, so maybe the sodium channel is still open, but the inactivation gate closes. Can you remember what that inactivation gate, what it looks like? Right here. All right, so here we see the sodium channel open, the inactivation gate is still open, but right at the peak of that action potential, what happens? This inactivation gate plugs the hole, plugs up the channel. Even though maybe it's still open, sodium can't move through this channel. And when sodium can't move through the channel anymore, what happens to depolarization? It stops. It abruptly stops, right? Because sodium can't enter the cell anymore through that particular channel. Okay, so you got to know depolarization is due to what ion? The sodium ion. And you also have to know the motion of that ion. Where is it going? From outside to inside. It's moving inside. And that is what we call depolarization, the first phase of an action potential. Okay. The other kinds of proteins in the membrane of axons are the potassium channels. They're slower. They get stimulated into opening with this stimulus right here once it reaches threshold, just like the sodium channels do, but they're slower to open. All right. And so that's what determines the second phase of an action potential. Right, so right at this point now, the potassium channels, most of them have opened up. And what does potassium like to do? Okay, it can move down its electrochemical gradient as well, passively. All right, so where do you find potassium? High inside the cell or high outside? It's high inside the cell. All right, so for the concentration gradient, it likes to leave. Now what about the electrical gradient? Which is that going to have an effect on potassium at this point in the action potential right here? Yes. Because what is the outside of the cell now compared to the inside? It is negative, yeah, because there is a polarity reversal as a result of this action potential. So potassium loves to rush out of the cell at this point of the action potential because of the concentration gradient and the electrical gradient as well. And it moves just passively, right, just by diffusion, yeah. Well, the gates are faster. The sodium channels, okay, open first. The potassium channels start to open, but they're slower. It takes a little time for them to develop. All right, now diffusion happens. Why does diffusion happen? Because of a concentration gradient, the size of the molecule. I think potassium is a little bit bigger than sodium, so it might not move quite as fast. The concentration gradient, we'd have to look at the concentration gradient to see which might move faster. I would say maybe sodium moves a little bit faster. It diffuses faster. Okay. So potassium is rushing out of the cell, and it continues to rush out of the cell even past resting membrane potential right here. And because those channels are still open, and they don't close until we get to this point right here in the action potential. So this is the third phase of an action potential, and we just call this an overshoot or a relative refractory period. And that is due to potassium leaving the cell still. All right, so those are the three major phases, and as a matter of fact, maybe I would like to include this pre-phase right here, and this is what? The stimulus. So there has to be something to change the membrane potential. When will an action potential occur on an axon membrane? What's the necessary condition? The stimulus has to produce what? A voltage that is what? Minus 55 millivolts right here. And those sodium and potassium channels will then start to change their configuration and open up and allow these ions to move. All right, then after an action potential, right, you have sodium and potassium, they've moved down their concentration gradient. What restores the cell back to its original condition over here at RMP? What is always happening inside the cells? Yeah, the sodium-potassium pumps, right, are always pumping sodium out and potassium back inside the cell, requiring ATP. So that's what sets up this thing right here. This action potential just happens passively when the membrane potential reaches minus 55. And then afterwards, the sodium-potassium pump reestablishes those gradients again so that another action potential can take place.
What type of
stimulus will start that? Okay. Yeah, we're going to look at that. Those are called graded potentials. Okay, those are graded potentials. And we're going to talk a little bit more about action potentials first before we get into this stimulus right here. But anything that's going to cause that membrane to go from RMP up to threshold here could be an adequate stimulus. And maybe even if you were to touch an electrical socket, for instance, right, that's going to cause these neurons to conduct, okay, or to fire an action potential, yeah.
So the stimulus, does it have to be like negative 55 or like 10, like enough to bring it up?
As soon as the membrane potential reaches minus 55 right here, the action potential starts. Okay, I don't see where you're getting a positive. The stimulus right here.
Yeah.
Okay, it's got to be what, a positive? If this is minus 55, it's got to go from minus 70 to minus 55. It's got to be a positive 15 millivolt stimulus. Okay, at this point right here. All right, but what happens if a stimulus came along right at the maximum of this hyperpolarization? Would a positive 15 millivolt stimulus cause an action potential at this point? It won't, because it only brings the membrane potential to right here, which is below threshold. So a stimulus at that point, even though it's a positive 15 millivolt stimulus, we would still call that a sub-threshold stimulus. Or at this point, when the cell is at RMP, if something came along and was a positive 10 volt stimulus bringing the membrane potential to here, that still would be considered a sub-threshold stimulus. That wouldn't cause an action potential to start on that axon. Yeah.
But during the relative refractory period, if there wasn't stimulus powerful enough to reach
threshold?
Yeah.
an action potential would take place. And it's called a relative refractory period as opposed to an absolute refractory period. Yep. Okay. Okay. So I think we've talked about all of these things right here. Okay, just some more slides. All right, so depolarization and repolarization occur via diffusion. All right, and that diffusion is possible because the sodium-potassium ATP pumps set up the cell ahead of time to work this way. The action potential does not require active transport, but after the action potential, then that sodium-potassium pump restores the concentrations of sodium and potassium. All right, so you should definitely appreciate that an action potential, okay, is due to currents of sodium and potassium. All right, so here is just kind of a sloppily drawn action potential right here because I don't see threshold necessarily on this diagram, but you see what depolarization caused by sodium diffusing into the cell, repolarization caused by potassium diffusing out, and the potassium has this overshoot right here because the potassium channels are what? Relatively slow. When something is slow to open, it is also slow to close, right? That's just the nature of the time constant of those proteins. All right, so we could break this action potential down into those two currents or those two ions as they're diffusing. And that's what we see on the second graph down over here. We see the diffusion of sodium or potassium versus time. And so this first curve, notice that both curves start at the same time, but which shows a high rate of diffusion first? It is the sodium channels because they operate much more quickly. All right, so the voltage-gated sodium channels open to a larger degree first. All right, and so this is what we call the depolarization phase due to sodium. At this point in time, the inactivation gate for sodium channels closes, so that stops any further depolarization. And by that time, look what's sort of catching up to it. The potassium channels now more and more and more are open, and that channel right there is going to cause repolarization, but since they're slow to open, they are also slow to close, and that causes this area of hyperpolarization. Okay. And then at this point in time right here, both the sodium and potassium channels are closed, and the cell is back at resting membrane potential. All right, so when you look at an action potential deconvoluted into those two currents, into a sodium current and a potassium current, separate those two things out in your mind. Okay, yeah. Yeah, you know, I don't, that's one way to kind of explain evolution, why the potassium channels were selected that way. There's probably another reason as well, which I'll talk about in terms of refractory periods, okay? Okay. All right, so an action potential, all action potentials are pretty much identical. If it's on one nerve or another nerve, action potentials are also an all or none response. Once the threshold is reached for an action potential, like right here, right, once the membrane potential reaches threshold, an action potential is going to take place, and all action potentials pretty much are the same. Okay, they have a constant amplitude. They have a constant duration throughout the body. And so we call that the all or none response. So, for instance, here is a graph that shows a number of different stimuli, and the strength of the stimulus is illustrated by the length of this arrow right here. So here we see four different stimuli. The weakest comes first, and the strongest one comes last. Okay, and maybe the strongest one is twice as strong as the second one right here. So in this particular case, for the weakest stimulus, right, it does not produce an action potential. So what could you tell me about this weak stimulus right here? How would we talk about this weak stimulus? That is called a sub-threshold stimulus because it doesn't raise the membrane potential to minus 55 millivolts. All right, so that doesn't produce that signal, that stimulus, then is not propagated down to the axon terminus, right? It dies away in the axon, right? But if we have a stronger stimulus that reaches threshold, what happens? We get an action potential. And this action potential moves all the way down to the axon terminus just like this. It doesn't change amplitude. It doesn't die out. We say that action potentials are propagated without decrement. They don't change as they move down an axon, even though that axon might be a meter or two long. That signal does not degrade. All right, and if we come along with another strong stimulus, all right, that's even stronger, of course it's going to be a threshold stimulus and even greater, what does this second action potential look like compared to the first one right here? It looks exactly the same. And then even a stronger stimulus, what does the action potential look like? Exactly the same. Okay? All right, so when the membrane potential reaches threshold, an action potential is irreversibly fired. Right, and of course we can think of the various kinds of voltage-gated channels that produce the action potential depending on whether it's depolarization or repolarization. Right, action potentials cannot summate. Right, so if we applied a couple stimuli very close in time, right, then you might produce one action potential, but you can't have another action potential building on top of this first one. Right, and the reason why is because what's really happening in this region of the action potential? There is an area of hyperpolarization, and this stimulus right here is probably not strong enough to overcome that hyperpolarization to reach threshold. All right, so another thing to remember is that all action potentials have a constant amplitude from the beginning of the axon all the way to the end, but even in time, action potentials have this. Different action potentials have the same amplitude. Okay, so you might be wondering, let me just say one other thing. The way that your brain functions, the way that your brain appreciates information, or the language that your brain thinks is in action potentials. All right, so these little spikes of electrical activity is the way that you appreciate your reality. Okay, and that's how your brain thinks, by sending action potentials around through different neurons. So you might be asking yourself, well, if an action potential has a constant amplitude, how is it that I can experience reality with different amplitudes? Right, like I could be talking very softly, or I could be talking very loudly, but the action potentials that are going to your brain have the exact same amplitude, no matter what the intensity of the stimulus is. So it would be easy to understand how the brain functions if the amplitude of an action potential would change with the intensity of a stimulus, but it doesn't happen that way. So how do we explain why it is that your brain can experience differences in amplitude of the same kind of stimulus, whether it's vision or sound or smell or whatever? All right, so this slide describes what's happening there. So here on this slide, we have three different stimuli, and we keep them on for the same period of time in each case, but what are we changing about the stimulus right here? The first stimulus compared to the second compared to the third. Okay? Is the, what? The intensity of the stimulus, which corresponds to the strength, right, or the vertical axis. The intensity of the stimulus is shown by the height of this little square wave right here. So which stimulus is the highest, has the greatest stimulus, is the greatest amplitude? That's the third one. All right, so let's turn on some kind of stimulus and let's measure membrane voltage on some cell someplace. So we know we turn the stimulus on at this point and turn it off at this point right here, and we look at activity within the neuron, and what do we see in this region? We see nothing. So what do you know about this first stimulus? It is what we call a sub-threshold stimulus, and it doesn't occur. Why doesn't it occur? Why doesn't an action potential occur over here? Because it never reached threshold, right? The membrane potential never reached threshold. It may be depolarized a little bit, but it never reached threshold, so an action potential does not occur. Okay, now let's turn on the stimulus again, but let's make the amplitude a little bit higher, and voila, what do we see? We see some action potentials. And what can you tell me about the amplitude of these four action potentials right here? They're the same, okay? And we see a space right between the first and second action potential, because remember, after this first action potential, there is a relative refractory period, and the second stimulus now is not strong enough to overcome that relative refractory period. It is when the cell's at rest, but not when it's recovering from an action potential. And then when the cell recovers from the first action potential, right, then this stimulus is adequate enough to reach threshold, and what happens? Another action potential can happen. Right, and then after this second action potential, don't forget there's that area of hyperpolarization, and the stimulus is not strong enough to overcome it. So that hyperpolarization has to die away before this level of stimulus can cause another action potential. So the number of action potentials during this time is rather small. It's only four action potentials. But now let's increase. Well, let's let the system recover. Let's give it some rest. We'll give some rest to the neuron. And now let's increase the stimulus. We'll make it higher. Now, what can you, and what does that produce? More action potentials. And what about the amplitude of these action potentials compared to case number two over here? They are the same. All right? But how does your brain understand that the stimulus, the amplitude of the stimulus is now greater compared to the second case? Do you see anything different between case number two over here and case number three? The frequency of action potentials increases, right? The duration of the action potential is the same. The amplitude of the action potential is the same. But now they can occur faster in time because this stimulus can overcome that area of hyperpolarization much more quickly, right? It can compensate for that relative refractory period. All right, so the rate of action potentials going to the brain increases, right? The frequency increases as the stimulus intensity increases, not the amplitude of the action potential, okay? So we call that frequency coding. Do I have that on the next slide? Don't have that on the next slide. All right, so the way that your brain understands amplitude is by frequency coding, not by amplitude coding of action potentials. Okay, so if we were to listen to somebody's brain, what would we actually hear going on inside somebody's brain? Even though you might be listening to music, okay, there's not going to be music in somebody's brain. What's going to be taking place in somebody's brain? It's going to be these little blips, right, action potentials, and they just kind of sound like a blip, blip, blip. All right, so in terms of somebody playing a note on a piano very softly, right, there's just going to be a certain area in somebody's brain, if it's a very soft note, right, it's just going to be going blip, blip, blip. But if somebody hits a piano key really hard with their fist, just one note, bang, and it's a really loud note, what's going to be experienced in the brain? It's going to be blip, 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 blip. Okay, and so the brain understands the change of intensity by what? The change in frequency of action potentials. Okay. Okay, we call that frequency coding. All right, and frequency coding can be explained by what? Understanding this relative refractory period. So here we have another action potential that's plotted out, membrane potential versus time right here. And the absolute refractory period of an action potential starts immediately when threshold is reached, and it persists all the way until the inactivation gate can reset itself, and it resets itself when the membrane potential reaches RMP, the resting membrane potential. Then that sodium channel can open up once again, right? But it's closed because of that inactivation gate during this time. And if a sodium channel is blocked by the inactivation gate, there is no amount of stimulus that can cause depolarization to occur in that segment of the neuron. Okay, so how would you explain this absolute refractory period right here in terms of the best way is with the inactivation gate. That has to be reset, right? So because of this absolute refractory period right here, action potentials can never summate. You can never have an action potential and then add another action potential to it at this location because it can't depolarize anymore because of the inactivation gate. This is what we call a relative refractory period, okay, because here is the threshold stimulus at minus 55. A stimulus now has to overcome this area, this length of hyperpolarization before it can get to what the threshold voltage. So we call this relative refractory period. And what happens to the relative refractory period way out over here? What can you tell me about the extra stimulus that's needed to cause an action potential? It is slowly going away, right? And so way out over here, you don't need that extra stimulus to cause an action potential. So this is why the frequency changes when the intensity of a stimulus increases, right? Because of the slope of this hyperpolarizing region right here in an action potential. All right, so the other thing to kind of remember is, all right, so we're looking at an action potential. What kind of membrane channels are responsible for these changes in membrane potential? These are due to VG. What does VG stand for? Voltage-gated channels. Voltage-gated channels. And they open when, what happens? When there's a threshold stimulus. Okay? And which voltage-gated channels are faster? The sodium. And the slower ones then are the potassium. All right, so the sodium opens first, and that causes what? Depolarization. The potassium channels are slower, and that causes repolarization and then hyperpolarization because they're slower. Okay, so you should have a feel for which way those ions are moving. Okay, so that's one kind of way. That's one way that neurons communicate information is through action potentials. All right, there's another way. And these are due to ligand-gated channels. Okay, so if we inject some kind of positive charge into a cell, like maybe a dendrite or the cell body or even on an axon, okay, and let's not think that if this is a model of an axon right here, that it has any voltage-gated channels, or if it does have voltage-gated channels, the amount of positive charge that we put inside the cell is always going to be what? It's not going to reach threshold, it's going to be sub-threshold, so it doesn't cause an action potential to take place. But anywhere on a neuron, we can inject positive charges into the cell, maybe with this electrode, and just hooking it up to a battery. Right, we turn it on for a short period of time and turn it off. All right, so this is going to be a plot of voltage versus distance along a cell. All right, so what can you tell me about, so this is what we call a graded potential. It's not an action potential, and you can see immediately this is not an action potential because as we look down the length of this axon right here or over some distance on the cell, how do you know this is not an action potential? Because the amplitude is what? It's dying away as it moves from this site of stimulation right here. Okay? So hence we call these graded potentials because they die away over time. They propagate with decrement. So how would you talk about an action potential in terms of propagation? An action potential is propagated with out decrement. It doesn't decrease as it moves down an axon, but graded potentials do. All right, and that is because there is resistance to flow of electricity down an axon because there is resistance within the cell body or dendrite of a nerve cell. And current can also leak out through various kinds of channels that are in the membrane right here. So What kind of, when we inject positive current inside the cell, is that going to stimulate the cell or inhibit the cell from firing an action potential? It's going to stimulate the cell because it raises the membrane potential toward what? toward threshold. So this is a stimulation. If we were to put negative charges into the cell, what would happen to the resting membrane potential? It would hyperpolarize it, right? It would go the opposite way. And would that be stimulatory or inhibitory on the cell? That would be inhibitory because it's taking it farther and farther away from threshold right here. Okay. So, this is what happens in a neuron. All right, there can be graded potentials that are accumulated by all of these dendrites in the cell body. Yeah. Okay, say that one more time. The stimulus right here?
Yeah, if it happens in the axon, it's only a graded potential because it doesn't hit threshold.
It's a graded potential because of other membrane proteins that we're going to look at in just a second. Okay? If the voltage-gated channels are stimulated by some kind of voltage that reaches threshold, that's what's going to produce an action potential. But these graded potentials are caused by other kinds of proteins inside the membrane of a neuron, and those are called ligand-gated channels. So there's two kinds of channels that are controlled by two different kinds of events. One is controlled by voltage, and the other is controlled by a signaling molecule. And that little signaling molecule is what we call a ligand, because it's going to bind to a receptor on the outside of the cell membrane. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what we're going to look at. So we got to piece a number of steps together. So this is kind of a hard topic because I have to actually lecture for about 3 days before you can really gain an understanding of what's going on. There's no way to learn everything all at once, unfortunately. Yeah.
Is that what you call summation then?
Oh. Yeah. Graded potentials, unlike action potentials, can summate together. All right. So if over here we have one electrode that will stimulate the cell, but let's put another electrode over here and stimulate it at two different locations, one electrode will produce a subthreshold stimulus, and this electrode over here will produce a subthreshold stimulus, but when those stimuli flow together, they can add, they can summate, and when you put two of these together, guess what happens? That's more than enough to reach threshold, and then that will cause an action potential. Yeah, so graded potentials can summate. Action potentials can't. Okay? So, yeah, we're going to get to that in just a second. All right, so now we're going to talk strictly about this axon right here. If there is a graded potential that reaches this region right here, the axon hillock, all right, and if it's threshold, guess what's going to happen? An action potential is going to take place. What are those two phases of an action potential again? You got depolarization due to sodium channels, you got repolarization due to those potassium channels. All right? And along the whole length of axon right here, you have all of those voltage-gated channels. So when this region right here reaches threshold, right, and you have this large action potential, right, sodium is rushing in, guess what happens to this region of the membrane? Right? It starts to depolarize because of this action potential right here. And when it reaches threshold, what happens in this region of the axon? Then, when it reaches threshold, an action potential starts here. Okay? And sodium starts to rush in. And when this area depolarizes, guess what happens to this next region of the axon? It starts to depolarize. And when it reaches threshold, what happens? Action potential starts. All right, so an action potential is going to move down an axon, right, because of those voltage-gated channels. And when you have an action potential moving down an axon, what do we call that? That's what we call an impulse, right, a nerve impulse. So an action potential in one part of the axon is going to cause an action potential in the next part, which is going to cause an action potential in the next part, on down the line. And what can you tell me about the amplitude of an action potential at this proximal end of the axon? Has constant amplitude. What about in this middle part of an axon? Same amplitude, right? And then the distal part of this axon, the action potential is going to have exactly the same amplitude. So these signals, and this is actually pretty fascinating, the signal moves down this axon, without losing any intensity whatsoever, okay, without decrement. That's fascinating. We don't know how to do that with our electronics these days. Whenever you transmit signals, it dies away over time. But biology has figured out a way to transmit information long distances without losing any intensity. That's pretty amazing. Okay. So this kind of conduction, where you have these voltage-gated channels that have to change their state, right? One channel by next channel by next channel by next channel, you know, molecule by molecule down the axon, we call this continuous conduction. And it happens relatively slowly. Continuous conduction happens at about 2 miles per hour. It's really nice because it's conduction without decrement, but it's relatively slow. Okay, this is continuous conduction. Now, how has biology figured out how to increase the speed of conduction? It's by myelinating axons. All right, so here you put this region of insulation. What do we call this in the peripheral nervous system? This would be a Schwann cell, okay? And underneath the Schwann cells, there are no voltage-gated channels whatsoever, because that would defeat the purpose of the insulation around the neuron. So if you have an area, okay, right here at, what do we call this area between the Schwann cells? That's the node of Ranvier. Now here we do have voltage-gated channels, all right? So when this area reaches threshold, what happens? Very rapid depolarization, right? A rapid change in membrane potential. And on the other end of the Schwann cell, it can appreciate that change in voltage over here very quickly. And this region is going to start to depolarize. And when it reaches threshold, an action potential is going to start. And then that's going to set up a current way down over here at the other end of the Schwann cell. Right, so this area is going to depolarize, and then this area right over here. So action potentials don't have to be transmitted molecule by molecule by molecule, but it can hop from one end of the Schwann cell to the other end of the next Schwann cell to the other end of the next Schwann cell. And so this is a very rapid way that action potentials can be propagated along an axon because of these nodes of Ranvier. Yeah. You know, I don't think it's going to change the rate of depolarization or hyperpolarization right here. It's just going to speed the rate of impulse conduction from one node to the next. So these areas underneath the Schwann cell won't depolarize, only the nodes between the Schwann cells. All right, so an action potential doesn't have to move one molecule by one molecule by one molecule, but it actually hops down an axon from node to node. All right, so the speed of conduction changes from about 2 miles per hour up to as much as 300 miles per hour as a result of this myelination. All right, so that increases the speed of conduction. So think of maybe running up a flight of stairs or something. All right, I tell you what, how about if we run down a flight of stairs? That's easier, right? All right, so start at the top of the stairs and run down. And what would be faster if you have to step on every single stair on your way down, or what, say if maybe you're strong enough you could skip every third or fourth step, okay, just run down and touch the third step and then the next third step, what would be faster, right? If you can skip steps, right, it would be a lot faster getting down those flight of stairs. All right, so this kind of conduction right here is what is not continuous conduction. This is what we call saltatory conduction. So saltatory conduction is a lot faster. More than 10 times, it could be 20 to 50 times faster, right? Maybe even 100 times faster if it is a myelinated fiber. Okay, so you got to know continuous conduction versus saltatory conduction. And so that's why when somebody has multiple sclerosis, the timing of how the different neurons in the brain communicate with each other gets all messed up. Okay, and so they experience those motor difficulties, cognitive difficulties, because the neurons aren't communicating with each other fast enough.
What causes the unmyelination?
Oh, during multiple sclerosis? Yeah, it's an autoimmune disease. Yeah, they just they get attacked by antibodies that the person's body is making. For some reason, the person's body thinks that, and it's myelin that's in the central nervous system, not the peripheral nervous system. The person's body recognizes it as being a foreign substance, and it's rejected, unfortunately. So that kind of gives you an idea how you could kind of treat those things, right? By suppressing a person's immune system. Yeah, yeah. Which is probably easier said than done, because then you're probably more susceptible to what, tumors and infections and everything else. So it should be done by an expert who knows how to tailor those drugs. Okay, so don't forget, saltatory conduction is a way that an electrical impulse or that an action potential can hop down an axon. Okay. All right, so that is action potentials. And on the sheet that you have right there, okay, you know what, who's got a sign-in sheet? Oh, I got a sign-in sheet. Here's a sign-in sheet. It's blank. You'll have to put the course on it. I couldn't find the one from last time. All right, so here is, here's a neuron. And what kind of neuron does this look like to you again? Multipolar. And actually, I want to embellish this region right here a little bit more like that. So what are these small processes here? These are dendrites, right? And here is the soma or the cell body. This thing right here is the, axon hillock. And then this is the axon. And then this is the axon terminus with a little bouton terminale right there, or terminal bouton, or terminal button, or however you want to talk about it. What's inside these things right here? Neurotransmitter, right? Okay. And this guy right here, though, the job of this one is to transmit electrical impulses, right, or electrical information. Now, which way does electrical information flow in a neuron? Can it go all over the place, or is it usually unidirectional? It goes in one direction from dendrites, the cell body, down an axon, okay? And I think at the very beginning of this lecture, we said that this right here to here is the receiving end. Receiving end. And this over here is the sending end. All right, so we can start to fill this in a little bit. And the receiving end is different than the sending end because of membrane proteins. So what kind of membrane proteins are in an axon that can transmit electrical information? Okay. Well, it's got myelin sheath, don't forget, those are lipids. Well, what's right inside the membrane, those proteins? Those are the voltage-gated channels. Voltage-gated channels are over here. Dendrites and cell body don't have voltage-gated channels. So dendrites and cell body don't have, what were we just looking at? If you have voltage-gated channels, what can you have? You can have action potentials. What are the two kinds of voltage-gated channels do you have to have in order to have an action potential? Sodium channels for depolarization, potassium channels for repolarization. All right, since the dendrites and cell bodies don't have those kinds of voltage-gated channels, we don't have action potentials over here. All right, now why is it that action potentials can only go from the axon hillock down to the axon terminus? Because when this area right here depolarizes, what happens to it? It goes into a refractory period, right? So that when this region right here depolarizes, it can't go back because this region is in a refractory period. Well, what about this region right here? It's not in a refractory period, right? So it can start to depolarize, right? And then this region here can start to depolarize, but why can't it go back again? Because this region is in a refractory period, so it can't go backwards. So impulses only go in one direction because of that refractory period. Okay. All right, now, so we see electrical activity over the neuron, and there's going to be another neuron over here, and it has some dendrites. There's that little synaptic knob right there. Okay, and actually, what should I do? They don't really touch each other. They come close. All right, so an electrical signal or an action potential from, this is what we call the presynaptic neuron, can't hop into the, this is what we call what, the postsynaptic neuron because of that space right there. So now we're going to look at how neighboring neurons communicate with each other. So we're going to look at this structure right here. All right, and we're going to model that in our mind. We're going to call that a synapse. All right, but what the heck is a synapse? It's the structural, which means that we got to learn some structure, and functional unit of communication between cells. It's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. And if we know how one synapse works, guess what? We're going to have a pretty good idea how all cells communicate with each other. I think in one of the previous chapters, I said that there was just one little detail, and that is there are two main kinds of synapses in the body. There are chemical synapses, and what's another kind? Electrical synapses. And so what we're going to talk about today is a chemical synapse because when we looked at the electrical synapses, what can you tell me about the two cells that were next to each other? They were actually touching each other, and there was actually a tunnel between them called a gap junction that allowed for sodium to go from one cell to the next cell. All right, so maybe I'll just draw this out. Let's say we have two cells right here, and it's got a gap junction between them. And let's all of a sudden, let's just say that here is a high sodium. Maybe sodium went into this cell. When sodium goes into this cell, what happens to this cell? What do we call that when sodium goes in? That depolarizes the cell. And is depolarization stimulatory or inhibitory? It's stimulatory. All right, so now you have a high sodium inside this cell, low in this one. Guess what's going to happen to this one? Because of the gap junction, sodium is going to move into this cell. And what's going to happen to this neighboring cell? It's going to depolarize as well. That's going to be stimulatory. All right, so with a gap junction, sodium can go from one cell to the next, causing what? Depolarization in all those neighboring cells. But that's relatively rare. All right, this is the usual kind of synapse that works in our body. The cells don't touch each other. Electrical currents can't just hop from one cell to the other. And this is what we call a chemical synapse. So let's look at how a chemical synapse works. All right, so is the functional connection between neurons. The presynaptic neuron is the proximal neuron right here. The postsynaptic neuron is that distal neuron. And we call that the postsynaptic neuron. And synaptic transmission, or the way information is transmitted between the pre and the postsynaptic neuron, is by a neurotransmitter, if it is a chemical synapse. If it's an electrical synapse, what happens? You just have sodium diffusing from one cell into the next, and that depolarizes the next cell. Somebody had a question.
So in chemical synapses, the neurotransmitter are going into the dendrite of the next neuron?
Yeah, we're going to look at that. We're going to look at that. Okay, so yeah, let me talk a little bit about it. All right, so here's an example of a direct connection between cells. All right, so this is an example of an electrical synapse. So when sodium is high inside this cell, it can diffuse through this channel right here, which is what we call a gap junction, causing depolarization in a neighboring cell. These are rare in the nervous system. Okay, so here is a model of a chemical synapse. Okay, so here is just a tip of an axon, this little swelling right here. Inside the swelling, we have a number of vesicles with a signaling compound in it that we call a neurotransmitter. And an action potential is going to flow over the axon to this axon terminus. And when an action potential comes down, what happens to the membrane voltage? Does it stay the same? Or what happens to the voltage on the membrane as an action potential comes along? Yeah, it becomes more positive. Another way of saying that is that it depolarizes. And in the end of an axon right here, not only do you have sodium and potassium voltage-gated channels, you have another kind of voltage-gated channel, namely a calcium channel. All right, so now you have three kinds of channels. You have the sodium, potassium, and calcium. And when the membrane depolarizes, this calcium channel opens. Now, where did you learn calcium was high? On the outside of the cell or inside the cell? It's high on the outside, so when this channel opens up, calcium diffuses down its concentration gradient inside the cell. So normally, we don't have any calcium ions inside the terminal button. All right, but when an action potential comes down, it opens up these calcium channels. Calcium enters the cell, and it binds to a molecule that we call calmodulin. So there's a binding site to calcium on calmodulin. Usually, calmodulin is inactive when there's no calcium on it. It becomes activated, and when it becomes activated, all right, when it's bound to calcium, it can change the activity of a protein kinase enzyme. Right? In the presence of calmodulin, when it's activated, it activates a protein kinase. What's the job of a protein kinase? So I tell you, what else can you tell me about when you hear that term, protein kinase? What's it going to do? It's going to have some kind of function. It's going to add a phosphate group, right, to a protein someplace. Right, it's going to phosphorylate a regulatory protein, and when that regulatory protein is phosphorylated, what's going to happen to it? It's like poking you in the side. All right, that protein is going to change conformation, and if a protein changes shape, it's going to change activity, right? Because the shape and activity are related to each other by conformation via active sites. All right, so these phosphorylated regulatory proteins can open more calcium channels, but these proteins can also cause fusion of these vesicles to the presynaptic membrane. And when they fuse, right, this little vesicle bursts open and the neurotransmitter is released into the space between the cells. And of course, these are neurotransmitters, so the neurotransmitters then diffuse from an area of high concentration to the postsynaptic membrane, which is an area of low concentration, right, just by diffusion. All right, so this shows us the release of neurotransmitter as a result of this electrical impulse reaching the end of the axon terminus right here. All right, so action potentials reach the axon terminus, the voltage-gated calcium channels open, calcium in the cytoplasm activates proteins, leading to fusion and release of neurotransmitters, right? So we just call this, what is this process called of the secretion of neurotransmitter? That is exocytosis, okay? Now, is this a passive process, moving these vesicles around and the release of neurotransmitter? You know what? Moving vesicles around requires microtubules and ATP, so this is active. So the other kind of organelle that I don't see on this illustration right here that should be here are organelles that make ATP, which are mitochondria, right? So this should also be loaded with mitochondria. Hence, right, this is a lot bigger area than the axon itself, right? Because there are more organelles. You got vesicles and mitochondria and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Only in the Bouton terminale, right? So you don't have calcium channels along an axon, right? It's just down over here. Okay, so action potentials travel down the axon to depolarize the Bouton that opens voltage-gated channels. The calcium is driven by the electrical chemical gradient, right? Because the inside of the cell is negative, the concentration of calcium is high on the outside, and that triggers the exocytosis of vesicles via a chemical, right? The first activating chemical is what we call calmodulin. Guess where it got its name from? Because calcium, yeah, it binds up calcium, all right, which then activates protein kinases, which then results in exocytosis of neurotransmitter. Okay, the neurotransmitter then diffuses across the synaptic cleft, and it binds to a receptor protein on the postsynaptic membrane. All right, and let's see what this next picture looks like. Oh, what happened to my picture? I'm going to have to describe it to you. All right, so here's a neurotransmitter, and it has a particular shape. All right, these neurotransmitters can't enter the postsynaptic cell right here because they are hydrophilic. Okay, so they can't enter they can't signal anything inside the cell. They have to bind to a receptor that is on the cell membrane that's on the outside of the cell. And when they bind to a receptor, okay, it is, I got to have a picture of it. Let me look. Ah, this is good. All right, so here is an example of the postsynaptic membrane right here. And a neurotransmitter, in this particular case, acetylcholine. Here we see a binding site for acetylcholine. When the neurotransmitter is released from the presynaptic membrane, it's going to bind here and here. And for this particular receptor, when two molecules of acetylcholine bind to this protein, notice that it changes shape. And it's not just a receptor, but it is also a channel protein. So when acetylcholine binds to this receptor channel, it opens up. And what can happen to sodium then? It can diffuse inside the postsynaptic cell. And when it diffuses inside the postsynaptic cell, what happens to the membrane voltage? It changes. It depolarizes, right? So this particular neurotransmitter is going to depolarize the postsynaptic membrane as a result, because of this sodium entering the cell. All right, so this is not a voltage-gated channel. We call this one a ligand-gated channel because the neurotransmitter is just what we call a ligand. It binds to a much bigger membrane protein right here. Okay, so when ligands bind to those ligand-gated channels, that causes depolarization. And depolarization is what? Excitatory, right? And the length of time that that ligand-gated channel is open then changes the state of depolarization of the postsynaptic cell. When there's more neurotransmitter, the depolarization is greater. When there's less neurotransmitter, the depolarization is less. So ligand-gated channels produce what we call graded potentials. They can change intensity depending on the amount of neurotransmitter that's in the synaptic cleft. All right? And so when you have a receptor channel that produces depolarization, we call that depolarization and excitatory postsynaptic potential. Because which way does the membrane potential go? Does it go closer to threshold or farther away from threshold? It is closer because sodium is entering the cell. Okay. There's something else that can happen. Maybe a neurotransmitter is going to bind to a receptor protein that's not going to open up a sodium channel. It might open up a chlorine channel, for instance. And where is chlorine high? Outside the cell or inside? It's high outside. And what's the charge on a chlorine? It's a negative charge. All right, so when that chlorine channel opens up, what is chlorine going to do? It's going to move from high concentration outside the cell, inside the cell, where it's low concentration. What's going to happen to the membrane potential as chlorine enters the cell? It becomes more negative. And so is that going to be excitatory to the cell or inhibitory? It's going to be inhibitory because it's moving it, what, farther and farther away from threshold. So there can be two different kinds of ways that a neurotransmitter can affect the postsynaptic neuron. It can produce excitatory postsynaptic potentials if it opens up, for instance, a sodium channel, but it can also produce an inhibitory postsynaptic potential if it opens up a, for instance, a chlorine channel. All right, so these potentials right here, so EPSPs and IPSPs are what we call graded potentials. And then these things, of course, can sum together. If you have equal amplitudes of an EPSP and an IPSP, by the time they reach the axon hillock right here, which has voltage-gated channels, right? Let's just say you have an EPSP that's positive with an IPSP that's negative, and they merge right here. What's going to happen to them when they get to the axon hillock? They're going to cancel out. And what's going to happen to an action potential right here? Will it start if an EPSP and IPSP cancel out? Then nothing is transmitted down this axon, even though the neuron has received those that information. Okay. So IPSPs and EPSPs are graded potentials. They're produced by what kind of membrane protein? Ligand-gated channel. And where do we have ligand-gated channels? Everywhere over dendrites, yep, and even the cell bodies have ligand-gated channels. Okay. But dendrites and cell body don't have voltage-gated channels. Where's the first place where you start to see a voltage-gated channel on a neuron? The axon hillock, that's right. So, because voltage-gated channels have a threshold, this axon hillock can make a decision as to whether an action potential is going to be transmitted or not. So this is what we call an integration center. Here's just a cellular integration center, and the information has to reach a certain threshold before it's passed on to what, the next cell down the line as a result of that. As a result of integrating EPSPs and IPSPs within the axon hillock. So sometimes we call that the trigger zone as well, right? And it's an action potential will be triggered if EPSPs and IPSPs summate to reach threshold, but it won't trigger an action potential if there aren't sufficient EPSPs to reach threshold. So this is why we call this the integration center on a neuron. Okay, so graded potentials are variable in amplitude. Graded potentials propagate. How do they propagate? With decrement, for instance, right, if we stimulate this dendrite over here and we get a certain amplitude of a graded potential, all right, let's just say that's the amplitude of a graded potential. When it's over here, what happens to it? It's smaller. And by the time it gets over here, it is smaller still, and an even smaller over here. So it goes away, right? But that still might be a threshold potential if what? If it exceeds the membrane put the threshold over here at the axon hillock. That could still cause an action, could still trigger an action potential. Okay. And of course, graded potentials can summate because there might be more graded potentials originating from these other dendrites over here, and they will summate by the time they get to the axon hillock. So I actually like to look at this axon hillock as what kind of structure? As like if you were going to, I did have kind of a silly example. Let's just say your car needs oil, right? And you want to open up a can of oil and pour it in your engine, but you don't want oil all over your engine. You want it inside. What do you use? So a funnel, right? Something that will collect something and get it through a small aperture. So think of this axon hillock as a funnel that's funneling all of these graded potentials and having them summate to reach threshold or inhibit the cell, right, so that an action potential won't be generated or triggered. Yeah.
So the neurotransmitters can bind anywhere.
As long as there are membrane channels in there. Receptors. There got to be receptor channels. Ligand-gated channels.
Can they
oh, this cell body right here and all these dendrites, it might have maybe 10,000 other neurons touching it.
And they're all sending neurons.
They're all sending information at the same time. And some of them will be excitatory, some will be inhibitory. Right? And so it's the job of this neuron then to take all of that information and make sense out of it right here at the axon hillock. It integrates it right there before it's sending it along. Okay? And as the pathway is stimulated, for instance, in a learning process, maybe before you take a physiology class, maybe you have 1,000 neurons, all right, axon terminals stimulating the cell. But after a hard class, okay, how many axon terminals are stimulating this one neuron? Instead of 1,000, yeah, there's none left. No, okay, you might have what, 10,000, right? The number of synapses increases, right? And so that just describes the plasticity of the nervous system, right? Yeah. Okay, yeah, maybe let's go back. I tell you what, before I leave this, I want to get back to that. But before I leave this slide, let me just read the question right here. So what part of the neuron is the receiving part and why? The receiving part is dendrite and cell body because of the membrane proteins that are on that part of the neuron, which are ligand-gated channels, and they can only respond to neurotransmitters or ligands. What part of the neuron is the sending part and why? The sending part is the axon, because you don't have ligand-gated channels here, you have voltage-gated channels. And as soon as the voltage changes in one part, right, then that action potential is going to zip down this axon. And what would be a way you could increase the speed of an axon? Okay, by myelinating it, right? That increases the speed of nerve conduction because the action potential actually hops between the different nodes. Okay. Now, what about release of neurotransmitter? Let me go back to this slide right here. Okay. So the amount of neurotransmitter that's released into the synaptic cleft is going to determine how the ligand-gated channels, or how many of them, are going to open up. Right? And this neurotransmitter just has a relatively short lifetime within the synaptic cleft right here. So it's going to go away. There are a number of mechanisms where that neurotransmitter goes away. One of the ways that it goes away is because there might be an astrocyte up over here, and it's going to take neurotransmitter out of the synaptic cleft. Right? So that means that another action potential is going to have to come down and release neurotransmitter before another graded potential will be established in the postsynaptic membrane. Right, so if you have a slow rate of action potentials reaching the synaptic terminus right here, then you have a slow release of neurotransmitter. But if you have a high rate of action potentials, right, reaching the axon terminus, then you have more and more neurotransmitter that's going to be released, which means then that you have more and more graded potentials, or the graded potential will be higher in amplitude. So when is it that you have a high rate or high frequency of action potentials reaching the axon terminus right here? It's when the stimulus intensity increases on the dendrite. As the stimulus intensity increases way up over here, right, what changes? Not the amplitude of an action potential, but the frequency. So as the frequency of action potential increases on the synaptic knob, you get more and more and a more persistent release of neurotransmitter, which causes a greater and greater amplitude of the graded potential, which then has a greater chance of being a stimulatory event on this postsynaptic cell. So did I answer your question? Yeah? Okay. So the rate, as the frequency of action potentials increases on the presynaptic cell, then the amplitude of a graded potential increases, right? As the frequency decreases over here, the amplitude of a graded potential on the postsynaptic cell decreases. Okay, so where are we? We're through EPSPs and IPSPs. All right, so EPSPs, IPSPs, summate. If the membrane potential in the postsynaptic cell reaches threshold at the axon hillock, a new action potential is generated, and it's going to, how's it going to propagate from the axon hillock down to the axon terminus right here? With decrement or without decrement? Without decrement, okay? Only decrement occurs with graded potentials in this region of the cell. All right, and what changes is that you change from ligand-gated channels to voltage-gated channels in the axon hillock, and so this is where action potentials can originate. All right, so in the presynaptic neuron, you have action potentials conducted by the axon, cause what? Voltage-gated calcium channels to open up, and then that causes the release of neurotransmitter. The more action potentials you have, the more release of neurotransmitter you have, which means then you have more neurotransmitter reaching the postsynaptic neuron. The neurotransmitter is going to bind to a receptor channel, which we call a ligand-gated channel. And if it is a sodium channel, that's going to cause an EPSP or depolarization of the postsynaptic membrane. That's going to cause a graded potential in the positive direction toward threshold. Right, that graded potential is going to die away by the time it gets to the axon hillock, but it has to reach threshold before an action potential can take place. An IPSP will open a, it could open a potassium channel, for instance. What happens if potassium were to leave the cell? It becomes more negative, right? So a way to produce an IPSP is by either opening a chlorine channel that allows chlorine to enter the cell, causing hyperpolarization, or it could open a potassium channel, which allows potassium to leave, which is hyperpolarizing as well. So IPSPs could be produced by either one of those two things. All right, so next time when we come back, we're going to start talking about some specific neurotransmitters, like how acetylcholine works. Okay, that's a neurotransmitter. Hey, one. Hi. SI 130, same place.